Thank you all for coming. It's very nice to come back. And well, I think this talk is very different from all the rest of the talks here. I remember once in the cosmology class, Lathan Boyle said that there are two types of theoretical physics in the world. One type is very mathematical. That's for most of the faculties and the postdocs working at Perelman Institute. But I'm not that type. So you will not see anything about field theory here, nothing about QCD. Well, you do see QED once. Okay.
So just
let me just start. So today I'll present my work down with like my mainly about the electrodynamics inside and outside magnetars with my supervisor Andre Bilobardov, with Yuri Levin and Jonathan Zurich, who was here last week. So first, a brief review about magnetars. So magnetars is a subclass of neutron stars with ultra-strong magnetic field, usually above 10 to the 13 Gauss. And these magnetars all have very slowly spinning period, which is about 1 to 10 seconds. And up to now, we've identified around 30 sources. And there are some online tools we can use to do some simple analysis about the magnetars. So magnetars have exhibited various kinds of activities. And also I need to clarify some of the glossaries I used in this presentation. So first, magnetars have this kind of a giant flares, which is a very violent transient phenomenon. It reaches a peak luminosity up to 10 to the 47 ergs per second and rises on the millisecond time scale. And there'll be a less violent one called soft gamma rebursts. It's very similar to giant flares, but with less energy. Its peak luminosity is 10 to the 43 ergs per second. So apart from that, there's another kind of transient activity called outbursts, where magnetar shows an increase about 10 to 1,000 times above its X-ray luminosity above its quiescent level. And that outburst will, the light curve for that outburst will decay exponentially for months to years. Apart from such transient activities, magnetars has also shown this persistent X-ray emission, and that luminosity is usually much larger than its spin-down power. So it cannot be spin-down powered, it must be magnetically powered. Apart from that, magnetars have high surface temperature with luminosity 10 to 35 ergs per second, and effectively its surface temperature is something above 0.3 keV. If you want to know more, there's another paper which I've been studying about how this high surface temperature can be sustained. Magnetars also show various kinds of timing anomalies. For example, there's a glitch, just like a normal pulsar, and there's an anti-glitch. So in the glitch, you see this star suddenly spins up, and for the anti-glitch case, you see the star suddenly spins down. So here, there are just two example light curves. The left one is the giant flares, SGR 1900. You see there's an initial peak lasting about like 0.1 second. The rise time is several milliseconds. And then there's a long lasting tail, which is several hundred seconds. And then you can also see this kind of a quasi-periodic oscillations in the light curve. So on the right hand side is a synthesis of several outbursts, several events of the outbursts. So it's a flux increased by about like 10 to 1,000 above its quiescent level, and it decays exponentially on the time scale, months to years, 100 days. Okay. So the key questions about the magnetar is that, so once, since they are magnetically powered, so how can you convert the magnetic energy to radiations? Especially for the case of giant flares, you wanted this to be done very fast. And for our current picture, and that proposed, the magnetic energy is converted to radiations, possibly through a distorted magnetosphere. For example, the simulation done by Kyle Puffery has shown that once you have this magnetosphere which is overly twisted, once the twisted angle exceeds a critical value, there will be instability takes place in the magnetosphere. And then there will be reconnections, particle acceleration, and all these kind of radiations. So apart from that, the twisted magnetosphere has also been used to explain the quiescent persistent emission of the X-rays. So if you have a twisted magnetosphere, then the curl of the magnetic field going to produce a large discharge voltage that's going to accelerate particles, and then there's all these kind of radiative process in the magnetosphere that gives rise to this kind of outburst, persistent X-ray emissions, not outburst. So then the problem in these two pictures is that what's the origin of such magnetospheric distortions?
So you mean this, yeah. You have conversion in the magnetic energy of the magnetosphere?
Right? The both inside and outside.
Okay.
Yeah.
So because inside could be even larger.
Yeah, inside you have even larger magnetic energy. Yeah. So there's the outline of my talk. So first part will be deal with the electrodynamics inside the magnetar. Especially, I will discuss this how this plastic deformation of the magnetar crust can be used to model, for example, the outbursts of the Hall waves, the magnetar outbursts through the Hall waves induced plastic failures. And also, there's a thermal afterglow of giant flares that can also be produced by the plastic flow, by the plastic deformation of the crust driven by the external Alphen waves. And then the second part, I will talk about the process of the magnetospheric dissipation of the Alphen waves. Okay. So then this this project deals with how the what's the origin of the magnetospheric distortion, and the other two deals with how the magnetic energy is dissipated inside the crust or in the magnetosphere. So here, just a brief review of the neutron star crust. A neutron star is typically has a radius of 10 kilometers. And the outer 1 kilometer is the crust. So in the core is just nuclear matter. And in the crust, the bottom layer, there might be some nuclear pasta phase, which was a recent also a research interest. And then in the inner crust, which is above the neutron drift point, it is composed of the Coulomb crystal with free neutrons and free electrons. So in the outer crust, below the neutron drift point, is the Coulomb crystal with free electrons. And in the most outer layer, the crust might be just melted. So that's what people call the oceans. You have a liquid, ions, and electrons. Okay. So the thing that is very particular about magnetar is that the magnetic stress is so strong that it can possibly break the crust. So if the magnetic stress exceeds the critical stress of the crust, which is about 10% of its shear modulus, so here mu is the shear modulus, the crust will be broken and will undergo the plastic deformation. And we can define the critical shear magnetic field by equating the magnetic stress with the critical stress of the material. So once the plastic deformation is triggered, you can cause the motion of the full points and twist the magnetosphere. So here, I'm examining one closed magnetic field lines and project into the 1D. So this is the projection of 1D. So here, that's the north hemisphere, and here, that's a crust in the south hemisphere. So initially, the magnetic field is straight, which is a dashed line in the magnetosphere. Okay? And so once you have a plastic deformation, it's going to be deformed, and the magnetic field line is frozen into the material, so it will be displaced with the crust. And then you see like the foot point at the surface has also a displacement, right? It changes from this direction to here. And in this, after that, you see there's a toroidal magnetic field developed because of the displacement of the foot point. And then this toroidal field twists the magnetosphere, then the magnetosphere will be slowly untwisted and gives out this kind of emissions. And the crust has also have some thermal property. For example, when the crustal material is heated up, its critical stress will be dropped, right? The material will be softened. And also, there's also possible phase transition once you have the plastic flow. So here, that's the results from the molecular dynamic simulations. So on the x-axis, that's the shear strain. Y-axis is the shear stress. So when you increase the shear stress above something like a 10% here, the material yield and become plastic, and this shear stress drops to something like a 10% of its initial value. That's what we call the phase transition here. Okay. So one thing you include this kind of the thermal property of the crustal material, you'll find out this the plastic region can actually expand and propagate like a deflagration front. That's what they, Andre and Yuri, they propose something as a thermoplastic waves. The idea is that, so suppose from a locally plastic region, right, the magnetic energy will be dissipated to heat and heats up this local, local region. And that heat will be diffused outward and heat up neighboring region. So in the critical stress in the neighboring region can be dropped below the magnetic stress there. In that sense, you can induce more plastic failure. It's like a deflagration front. And the speed of the thermoplastic wave is given by the square root of the heat diffusion coefficient chi times b squared over 4 pi divided by the viscosity of the plasma. Okay, so let me just show you this movie of how the thermoplastic wave propagates. So here, the x-axis is just some depth, which in terms of meters. So the y-axis on the left is the magnetic field, which is the blue, which is the red line. Okay, and the dashed green line is the B critical here. So you see, initially, only in this small region near the origin, the magnetic field is larger than B critical. So you have a plastic region there, but everywhere else is intact. And on the right axis of the y-axis is the temperature, which will be shown in the blue one. Okay, so let me just start playing. So you see, like, the plastic region expands and propagates like a deflagration front, right? So initially you have, no, let me do it again. Right, initially you have this plastic region and it heats up, the temperature increases, and the temperature diffuses outward, reduce the B critical. Once it becomes plastic, you have this phase transition and it reduce more magnetic energy there. Any question?
What prescription do you use to describe this plastic material? So in this molecular simulation, I remember if it's under plastic deformation, the rate of change in strain is, I don't know, proportional to the pi stress and then some.
Yeah, we use some fiducial value for the time scale to reduce the stress. So mainly once you become plastic, your dB dt will be something proportional to minus alpha times b, where alpha is some 1 over time scale. Yeah.
So it's not like the strain will increase, but it's not the rate of change. The rate of change in strain is proportional to your pi stress. It's not like that.
It's not like that. It's not like that. It's some simplified prescription, yeah. So then in the first project I presented, just we want to understand what can drive this plastic flow in the crust. So the first thing we turn to is the Hall wave in the crust that's launched from the core crust interface. And the Hall wave is kind of a certain type of MHD where the magnetic field is only advected by the electron fluid. So here there's a cartoon showing how Hall wave is launched from the core crust interface. So here, initially, I have some kind of a magnetic gradient near the core crust interface that might be sustained by some current sheet or there. And then there's the blue and the green line is just the projection of my B field, Bx and By. And the red line traces the tip point of the magnetic vector. So as the Hall wave is launched, you see, like, the magnetic field is spiraled and propagate outward. So the oscillation can induce very large magnetic energy here, magnetic field strength here. And then we do this 1D simulations just following of the full crust, following this Hall wave dynamics. And we,
A question.
Sure.
In contrast to ordinary neutron star, do you have superfluidity here?
We don't consider the superfluidity here for simplicity, yeah. Superfluidity will definitely change, for example, the heat capacity, the specific heat, and the heat conductivity there, yeah.
And is the origin of magnetic field the same as standard neutron stars?
Yeah.
And why is it so different?
Just much stronger. A typical neutron star is about like 10 to the 12 Gauss. So here I'm talking about 10 to the 14 or 10 to the 15 Gauss. Yeah. So we include the elastic response in our simulations, and we assume stress balance is always achieved because the Hall wave is really a long, slow process. And we include the plastic response of the material. So the shear magnetic field is reduced by the plasma viscosity once the crust become plastic. And we set this time scale for the dissipation to be like 10 to the 4 second. And also the crust will be healed after a year or something. I mean, these are really just fiducial parameters, which we have no knowledge about it. But we can constrain with all these parameters with the phenomena. And we also include all these kind of thermal responses of the crust. Mainly, we evolve the heat conduction equation and include the heating from the plastic flow, the ohmic heating, the diffusion, and also neutrino cooling. The non-thermal emission is modeled from this theory proposed by Andre for the untwisting of the magnetic field lines in the magnetosphere. And we measure both the thermal flux, which we can measure from this thermal conduction equation, and the non-thermal flux from this model. Yeah, let me just show you this movie. That needs a little bit of explanation here. So on the top panel, I plot what's happening inside the crust. So here, x-axis is the depth below the surface. So here, there's the surface of the star. Here is the core crust boundary. The red line is my magnetic field in the crust. And the blue line is the temperature in the crust. Here, they're just initial magnetic field and initial temperature. There'll be a solid, or they might look black, it's a green line. That's the B critical at my initial temperature, so when the crust is not heated. And there will be a dashed green line, which you'll see something later as I play the movie. That tells you B critical in the real-time temperature. So once it's heated or become plastic flow, the B critical will drop. Okay.
So in most regions in the crust, there's no magnetic field?
That's the initial condition. That's the initial condition. So we drive the Hall waves from this core crust interface. Yeah.
So what's the direction of your magnetic field? Is it radial or what's the direction?
I have a radial component, and then I drive this Hall wave, which is the Hall wave gives you this shear magnetic field.
Okay.
So the radial is constant.
Radial does not change, which is.
Yeah, radial is not changing. Yeah. And then in the lower panel, I show mainly that's a light curve, just as the time, there's a timing in years. So there will be a blue line, which measures the non-thermal emission flux. And there will be a red line, which measures the thermal flux at the surface. If you want to convert that to the luminosity, you need to time a emission area, which is about 10 to the 12. OK, let me just place it. Oh, no. So you see, like as the Hall wave is launched, the magnetic energy is kind of transported outward and accumulates in the crust. So once the B reaches the B critical, the crust becomes plastic. And then the magnetic energy is reduced to heat. And you see, like there's a thermal component, the red one would be the thermal flux that goes out from the surface through the heat conduction. And there's a green one is because the displacement caused in the crust induces the twisted toroidal magnetic field in the surface that gives this non-thermal emission. And you see like the failure kind of propagates in two different ways, right? First, there's this kind of a slow one, going very slowly, slowly, slowly. And then there's also a fast process. Just wait a second. Yeah, this one is really fast and quite smooth. So the fast one is what I said before, just the thermoplastic waves. And for the slow one, I will talk more about that in the next slide.
Sorry, the blue line is the magnetic field energy?
This blue line,
uh-huh.
The temperature.
The temperature.
Yeah.
So what drives these bursts? Like what's the source of energy in this case?
I am launched from the core, actually.
So you have a continuous driving?
Yeah, I have a continuous driving from the core. Yeah, I've also tried to have this core energy decay. Yeah, but here I just showed show one case where I have a continuous driving from the core.
It's a constant drive.
Yeah, so here I set my B field at the boundary to be constant. Yeah, I've also tried a simulation where this one decays with time. Yeah.
The separation between these forces are not uniform. Right?
It's not uniform.
What's the physical meaning of this average separation? Is it the crust, the propagation time of your whole wave, or?
Well, it's mainly more like how fast you have to wait until your energy kind of reaches the B critical here. Your magnetic field driven from the core can reach the B critical here. Yeah. So let me return to the propagation of the failures, plastic failures. So what happens about the Hall waves in the crust can be summarized in this flow chart. So first you have a Hall waves propagating the crust, and each time you test whether B exceeds the B critical or not. If it's not, so that's just normal Hall waves propagation. But once B exceeds the B critical, it induces plastic failures. And this plastic failure will dissipate energy into heat locally and soften the B critical in the neighboring region. And we then see whether the B critical can be softened below the magnetic field already there or not. If this condition is satisfied, then you launch a thermoplastic wave. Okay? So if the condition is not satisfied, a thermoplastic wave will not be launched. But in this situation, at the boundary of the plastic region, there's a discontinuity of the magnetic field because the plastic region of magnetic field is reduced, and that's not. And that discontinuity keeps launching small-scale Hall waves. For example, for simplicity, this solution can be described by the Fresnel integral, something like that. And these Hall waves can reach peak value larger than the initial B field there. And then that can also trigger failures. So this process is what I call the Hall wave mediated avalanche. It's like avalanche, right? The Hall wave stops here, and then you're driving small scale Hall waves and then induce more failures. That's the slower process. So the velocity of the Hall mediated avalanche, mainly there's a square root of time, there's the heating time scale, inverse heating time scale times the Hall diffusion coefficient, which is much smaller than the speed of the thermoplastic waves. So here, I just show two plots, which is the space-time, so that's the depth, and in time, of my B over B critical tells you how these two modes of the failures propagate. So for example, here, like initially I have a plastic region at the center, and then propagate outward through the Hall mediated failures. This is a slower process. Oh. The color stands for B over B critical. So when you have a plastic region, the B over B critical will drop to 0.1, which is all these blue region. So initially, there's a slow propagation of the whole mediated failures. And once the condition for thermoplastic wave is satisfied, you see you launch a thermoplastic wave, and it's much faster. And the right panel is just a pure thermoplastic wave. You see it's the label on the y-axis is different. This is 30 times 10 to the 6 second. This is only 8 times 10 to the 5 second. Okay. And just here, just the same plots, but for the temperature. So the thermoplastic wave is much faster, and the temperature increase can be much larger. And the Hall wave has smaller temperature. But the takeaway is the temperature can be increased well above 10 to the 9 Kelvin. So in that case, neutrino cooling will be the most important channel for the cooling process.
So the time scale for these are all like 10 to the 5 seconds. So it has nothing to do with this, let's say, giant fires.
No, we try to use this to model the outbursts. Yeah. So here are just the two light curves for the outburst. So on the upper panel shows the magnetospheric emission, the flux, meaning that's the non-thermal emission part. And there's the thermal emission, which is blue. So for the Hall mediated mode, the rise time is quite slow, which on the scale of months, weeks to months. And for the thermoplastic wave, the rise time is much smaller, much shorter, which is several days, a week, or something. That depends on how fast these failures can propagate inside the crust. And then the thermal flux is kind of conducting down on the time scale of a year, and it doesn't increase too much because most heat actually goes into neutrinos. Yeah.
So do you have some show light curves from some particular magnetars that you're comparing this to that you're trying to reproduce?
Well, we didn't do that. Yeah. But here, just from here, I mean, you see like the peak luminosity, if you times the 10 to the 12, can reach 10 to the 36, 10 to the 35 to 10 to the 36 ergs per second, which is typical for most magnetar outbursts.
Yeah. So you're just trying to get sort of like the ballpark, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other question about this? So then let's proceed. So let's proceed to another project. So apart from this kind of internally driven plastic flow, this plastic flow can also be driven externally, for example, by the alpha waves. A worm scenario that alpha waves can be launched is, for example, during the giant flare. You can have all these alpha waves launched on the closed field lines. And these energy can transmitted, the alpha wave energy can transmit it into the crust and dissipate it and heat up the crust. Probably they can give rise to the thermal afterglow of the giant flares. For example, this is the thermal afterglow for the SGR 1900. This is after 10 days, 100 days. So, right, so the alpha wave is trapped on the closed field lines. So each time it hits the surface, part of the wave will be transmitted. And then we run this 1D simulation to following the dynamics of the alpha wave from the magnetosphere into the crust. So in this case, we model all these dynamical processes. And there's no stress balance assumed there. And the dynamics of the alpha waves can be analytically understood in the following way. So when the alpha waves propagates in the crust, it's coupled with the elastic motion of the lattice. So the alpha speed will be reduced, will be given by this expression, and it will reduce in the crust. So in other words, when the waves propagate into the crust, its wavelength will be compressed and getting smaller and smaller.
Excuse me. Yeah. What do you call as a Hall wave?
Yeah.
The end of alpha wave, is that?
That's not the same thing.
Not the same.
Yeah. So here, just alpha wave. Yeah. So for Hall wave, it's like your magnetic field is only affected by the electron motion. So assuming your neutron is not moving. Yeah. And so the on this plot, I show this the comparison of the different scales, length scales. So one is the lambda, is the compressed wavelength inside the crust, and the other one is the hydrostatic length scale, which characterizes the length scale for the change of this alpha speed. So see, in the outer surface, the wavelength is much larger than the hydrostatic wavelength scale length. So whatever reflection and transmission can take place. But in the lower crust, when the wavelength is getting much shorter than the scale length, it's a WKB WKB regime. So the wave will just keep propagating with a constant flux, and there'll be no reflection. And we can estimate the transmission coefficient using the impedance mismatch from the vacuum and at this point when the tube scale length equals. And this estimation gives you something about 10 to 10%. And so here, this is the plot I show the transmission coefficient as a function of my background field. So for a larger, strong magnetic field, you have a larger transmission coefficient. And also when in the WKB regime, you can see like the string of the material will increase as the density of the wave will increase as the density to the power a quarter. That means this, when the wave is propagating into deeper and deeper, it's getting compressed, but the string is getting larger and larger. So once the string exceeds 0.1, which is a critical value for the crust, it will break the crust and then initiate this plastic flow. Yeah, I don't have the movie. So here I just show two results. This is my resulting temperature profile from this heating by the alpha waves into the crust. And you can see like they can increase the temperature a lot, and mostly constrained by the melting temperature of the crust. Because once the crust is melted, it becomes fluid. There'll be no more plastic formation anymore. And for the largest background field, I can reach melt all the crust up to like 700 meters. And then I just took this temperature profile into a thermal conduction code, and that gives me the light curve for this thermal afterglow. You see the light curve rises after time on the ear, and then reaches the peak flux 10 to the 22, which is something like a luminosity 10 to the power 34 to 35 ergs per second. And in this case, and also the temperature is much larger than 10 to the 9 Kelvin, so most heat is lost to neutrinos. In other words, the peak luminosity will saturate. So increasing heating will not increase the thermoluminosity, because those energy will just be carried away by neutrinos, which you cannot observe. Yeah. And this crustal heat absorption of the alpha wave is competed by the magnetospheric dissipation outside the magnetars, right? Because if most energy is dissipated outside the magnetar, there'll be no more wave transmitting to the crust. Actually, this process has the magnetospheric dissipation of the alpha wave has another implication about how the magnetar flare is generated. For example, in the paper by Toms and Duncan, what they say is that you have these alpha waves generated from the crust, and they dissipate in the magnetosphere and forms an optically thick plasma fireball that, that powers the emission. And the luminosity of this plasma fireball depends on how much energy ends up dissipating in the magnetosphere. So then we try to understand how the alpha waves can be dissipated in the magnetosphere. So let's just list what kind of process that can dissipate the wave energy. The first one is there's the turbulent dissipation from the nonlinear interaction of the two alpha waves. So when the two alpha waves collide, the nonlinear interaction can generate a smaller scales and cascade energy down to small scales and finally get dissipated. There's another process that when the two alpha waves, they come together, they can produce a fast wave through the three-wave interaction. And the third one is magnetic reconnection. Whether it's possible or not, I'm not sure. And there's some other exotic process like QED shocks, which was proposed by Heil and Hernquist 1998, and you see QED here. That's the only QED in my presentation. Okay. And I'll present my work mainly on the first and second channel here. I will not talk about anything about magnetic reconnection. So in order to study this, we turn to the simulation of this force-free electrodynamics. I mean, first we want to do the simulation of relativistic MHD. But relativistic MHD is very hard, especially when you have a very high magnetization. And the force-free electrodynamics is an approximation of relativistic MHD in that sense that the magnetic energy dominates over the rest mass energy of the plasma. So in other words, you can neglect the rho c square term in the stress energy tensor. So the plasma just follows the field dynamics with the vanishing Lorentz force. So in order for this condition to hold, you must have a magnetic dominance. So E field must be smaller than the B field, right? In other words, you can find a reference frame where your electric field vanishes. And there's a second condition where E dot B equals zero. And in force free, it can support two types of the waves. The first one is alpha waves, just like normal alpha waves. Omega is proportional to kz. So the group velocity is in the same direction with the background field. And the wave is confined on this background field. It cannot propagate in any direction. And there's another kind of wave, which is called the fast wave, has this kind of dispersion relation. This is something similar to the magnetosonic waves in the relativistic MHD or Newtonian MHD. But in the force-free limit, this fast wave is just a vacuum EM waves. It doesn't require any charge density or current density to propagate. So the three-wave interactions is not possible if you have two alpha waves to generate a new alpha wave. That's the same argument for relativistic MHD because of the dispersion relation and energy and momentum conservation. And also for two fast waves, when they come together, since there will be no charge current, there will be no charge density, there will be no current density. They're just a linear superposition of the two EM waves. So there's also be no interactions. The leading order interaction of the three waves is when you have two alpha waves that convert to a fast wave. Okay. So we do this simulation and set up a Cartesian box with a uniform background magnetic field, which I call BZ here. And this Cartesian box has periodic boundary condition. And in our initial conditions, we set up two Gaussian wave packets, two wave packets, not necessarily Gaussian.
What about full wave?
That's the next order. Yeah. But the leading order is the three-wave one, right? If you do the expansion. So these two wave packets, they just keep colliding with each other. And we measure how much energy is dissipated during this process. So for our numerical schemes, I used a very high order scheme, like fifth order Widow, to reconstruct the flux on the surface, and the rho solver for the Riemann solver. I used hyperbolic divergence cleaning. Yeah, I didn't do anything about constraint transport because I want to achieve high order. And here, E dot B is dynamically damped following the prescription by Parfrey 2017. And once you have this magnetic dominance is broken, so here the electric field is just normalized, renormalized artificially to restore the magnetic dominance. And that's something I'll talk about later. And the dissipation, the numerical dissipation in the code that might come from these two channels. The first one is the hyperbolic divergence cleaning, and the second one is the cleaning of E dot B. These two should diverge away, should converge away when you increase their resolution. Okay, so these two dissipations should not be important. And the channel, the reduction of the electric field also removes energy artificially. That will not converge away. And that's something I will discuss in the later slide. And then what's left is this grid heating. And we expect this grid heating to capture the true dissipation rate for a turbulent cascade, forward cascade with a constant flux. Right? If I get a constant flux, that flux is independent of the dissipation scales. So here are my results, how this turbulent spectrum developed in 3D. So we do observe a forward cascade with an isotropic power law spectrum. Taper to the minus 2, which is here. You see here, I plot this spectrum as a function of time. So initially, it's localized on large scales, cascades down to smaller scales, and then finally develop this cape. This is very noisy. This is typical for this system like called wave turbulence, because the cascade is driven by the interaction of the waves. It's different from the normal hydrodynamic turbulence, where the interaction of the vortices drive the cascade. And on the left, I plot this energy, which is scaled by its initial energy, as a function of time, how much collisions you get. You see, like, when I increase my resolution, the dissipation rate I get is consistent. And there's a certain time, I call onset time, I call T onset here, whether you have a fast dissipation takes place. And that fast dissipation takes place is at around this time when the energy cascades down to the dissipation scale of my computational box. For example, here is about 24, and something here, 30, right? The energy reaches the dissipation scale. And here, I just plot how much energy is lost, the fraction of energy lost, as a function of time and for different amplitude. For small amplitude, you see like the dissipation rate is just small. You see nothing. And for the large amplitude, you see the step-like function, right? That's each time when the two waves collide, they lost some energy. And in the later time, it becomes continuous, because when the two wave packets, they just get stripped with each other, it fills the whole region of the central strip of the box. So it's not discrete anymore. So on the right, I plot this, the fraction of energy loss after the first single collision as a function of my wave amplitude psi. So for small amplitude, the energy loss is very small. So only when you have amplitude much larger than unity, for example, here equals 3, you get energy loss rate 5%. Okay? Yeah, well, 5%, which is still small than the transmission coefficient into the cross, right? Each time it hits the cross, it lost 10%. But here, if you get a very large amplitude, you only lose 5%. So then we try to evaluate how much energy is carried away by these fast waves, because fast waves can propagate in whatever direction, and they can possibly escape the magnetosphere. And that will carry away energy. So we add an ohmic dissipation layer to the boundary of the transverse plane perpendicular to my background field. Because alpha waves is confined to move along my background uniform field, they cannot reach that boundary. So any energy that reaches this boundary must be carried by the fast waves. And I put an ohmic dissipation layer there to damp that energy and measure how much energy is actually lost. So here, the dashed line is the simulation results with the boundary absorbing layer and the solid line without. So you see, like, the the removal of fast waves doesn't take away much energy. It's still on the level of several percent. And also, when I increase the amplitude of the waves, there will be less energy taken away by the fast wave in the early times. This is because when the amplitude is larger, the nonlinear interaction becomes stronger. So the fast waves coupled with the primary alpha waves and participate in the turbulent cascade before they can reach the boundary and escape. Okay? So just compare with the 10% transmission rate of the alpha wave into the magnetar. The magnetospheric dissipation is weak unless the amplitude is much larger than unity. So most wave energy is lost inside the magnetar and should power the thermal emission. And there will be some residual wave energy still left in the magnetosphere that can power the fireball emission. And the one implication is that the wave energy can be much larger than the observed radiation, since most heat is lost to neutrinos. Okay. Now let me return to that point of the breaking of the magnetic dominance. So all my previous simulations are done for alpha waves have the same polarization. So in other words, so when the two waves come together, their B field is pointing in the same direction. And since one is left-hand side, the other is right-hand side, when they come at, collide at the center, you see like the B field adds up and the E field cancel each other. So you cannot break the condition where E is larger than E is smaller than B. But if this case is the opposite, when the B field are anti-aligned, nonlinear interaction can induce E larger than B and break the force free condition. So usually what people do is I just artificially reduce the E field to restore the magnetic dominance and assume this process simulates the realistic fast dissipation. For example, as done by McKinney and Spikowski. So here I just plot the fraction of energy loss rate due to my removal of this electrical field due to the breaking of the magnetic dominance as a function of the relative polarization angle between the two alpha waves. So you see, like, when at 0 degree, when they are aligned, there will be no dissipation at all. And in 180 degrees, this is in the case when they are anti-aligned, there will be a maximum here. And there's a second peak at 90 degrees. This is also due to the breaking of the magnetic dominance, but it's not directly. The idea is when the two waves, they are 90 degrees, they come to the center, the E field, B field don't add up, but the E dot B will not be zero, right? So you will see like the magnetic field of the one wave will be aligned with the electric field of the other wave. So their E dot B will add it up and contribute a non-zero value. So in this case, you will need a larger electrical field parallel to their background field develop to cancel this E dot B. And that E parallel can be large enough and break the magnetic dominance. That gives you this peak around the 90 degree case. So then let's see whether this dissipation, high dissipation, is realistic or not. So we compare this force-free electrodynamic results with the relativism HD result. The same initial conditions. And for the RMHD, the sigma we use is 25. I think it's high enough. We check with sigma equals 50. That doesn't change the results. And the dashed purple line is the energy evolution for the force-free case. And you see, like, once when the two waves collide, once you remove this energy, it's just lost forever and will never recover. But what's happening in the relativist MHD case is that the wave energy, which is a blue line, is dropped and converted to the bulk kinetic energy of the plasma in a kind of reversible way. So when the waves pass through each other, the plasma gives the energy back to the waves. There's a little bit of dissipation, which is level like 10% or something, but it's much smaller than what you find in the phosphoric case.
Where does this thermal component come from?
Just from this plasma thermalization, yeah. It's not totally reversible. There will be some dissipation there. Yeah. It's not resistive. It's just realistic MHD. Yeah. They'll trace the internal energy of the plasma, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any dependence on the resolution of that plot?
Yeah, you can see here. Well, probably might not see clearly. There are several lines, right?
That's for the ideal MHD, but not for the force free.
Well, that I've also checked, that doesn't depend on the resolution. Yeah. Because mainly you can actually calculate here how much energy is lost, right? So when you just superimpose them together and see, okay, what's the fraction of the energy lost there?
Have you tried different implementations of the magnetic dominance condition? You have a particular one.
Yeah, I have a particular one.
There are ways of doing it.
Okay, I don't know that. I haven't tried that. Yeah, I'd love to know that. Okay, sure. I think here I come to the end. So I've done this electrodynamics inside the magnetar and show that this Hall wave mediated avalanches and the thermoplastic wave is able to reproduce the light curves of the transient magnetar outbursts. And also external Alphen waves can also trigger plastic flow and leads to the thermal afterglow. For the magnetospheric dissipation, what we find is the loss of the magnetic wave energy to turbulent dissipation or fast wave is slow. And most often, wave energy should be dissipated inside the magnetar. But there's a caveat here. I didn't discuss the possibility of reconnection. That's something I'm doing right now. So there's some future direction. For example, how can we correctly model this dissipation when the magnet dominance is broken in the force free? And whether there'll be magnetic reconnection in that regions, right? Especially when we have two anti-aligned waves come together, there'll be a transient current sheet formed at the center. Whether this process can be tearing unstable and reconnect the magnetic reconnection and accelerate particles. And the possibility, and also we didn't include the realistic geometry of the magnetosphere, right? We just assumed that the background field is uniform. So supposing a dipole configuration, your background field strength will drop as it goes away from the magnetar. And in that case, when the wave propagates to that region, the amplitude will increase a lot. Yeah, finally, just something. For example, we can do some simulation that couples the crust and the magnetosphere. And the last one is whether there will be some connection to fast radio burst, gamma ray burst, or neutron star mergers. For example, I know there are several proposals about this fast radio burst from these kind of waves. Okay, thank you.
So, questions for you?
If you go back and you extract in the comparison the force rate with the ideal MHD, and you go back to that case, see what happens after, related to your last one of your points in the last slide, which is how you model in force free what happens when you lose magnetic dominance. Of course,
yeah.
If you go there, the force free equations make no sense. In fact, they hold.
Yeah.
So you won't perhaps want a particular subgrade model or something to account for that. But can you gain some guidance from this plot? I mean, you see what happens after t equal 0.3.
Yeah.
That's what A, E and B are doing, and perhaps try to motivate a phenomenological way of accounting for it?
Yeah. What I'm thinking is probably I can add an extra field. For example, I've taken this energy away to add into the external field and then put them back. Yeah.
Perhaps a naive question, but this field, the magnetic field is so strong.
Yeah.
That you would naively expect particle creation effects also, right?
Yeah.
And that will certainly not be carried by the force-free condition.
Yeah.
So can one even estimate the size of the effect compared to the things you're taking account of?
Yeah, the vacuum polarization is, right, you have a single photon can convert in the strong magnetic field, convert to electron plasma positron pairs, right?
Yeah, you could have a cascade. And
sure. Well, it doesn't. It turns out that's not important in all this process I've discussed. There will be some, And that will be important, for example, in the giant flare emissions. But in this here, I mean, it turns out it's not observationally important. Yeah.
Know that somehow?
Yeah, we can.
I don't know that.
Yeah, so how do we know that?
How do we know that? Just the density is so low also in the magnetosphere.
The power density.
The plasma density, yeah.
So also the, your last comment, you have some comment about the connection between unusual stars. So a few years ago, we did simulations with the force ring kind of equations. That was ideal resistive MHC. But we were resolving what would happen when two stars would come together in a binary merger, and then where there was alignment or misalignment of fields, and there's quite a zoo of interesting things yeah. were coming up, but maybe you might want to take a look, given your really gained insights.
Yeah, I would love to.
That story was not fully completed by any means.
Yeah, currently what I'm thinking of is you have, for example, you have two magnetars, right? They have this magnetic axis to be anti-aligned. So during the final in spiral phase, right? Their magnetic sphere will be distorted by each other, right? Actually, they're forced together. That's kind of a good site for the forced reconnection. Where if you have this reconnection and have particle acceleration, that can be used as a precursor for this merger event.
Yeah, so you can take, I mean, all this was analyzed within limitations in those who come together this way, come this way.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Were you considering magnetic fields there? No, well, it was general. So with magnetars, you have this on steroids. There we were mainly concerned with how the topology of the fields coming on each star will be modified close to the merger. And then in one case, you use lots of reconnections in other ones. You kind of deflected magnetic fields in a significant way, and then you had a very interesting pattern.
Yeah.
You showed one instance where a force ring was failing to capture like sigma goes to infinity limit of MHD. Are there other results or other situations that people looked at where you worried that this might be giving you the wrong physics?
Other situations?
Yeah, that have been looked at with force ring.
As far as I know, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. So let's thank you again.